your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, let's see who can win the gold medal today. I'm feeling it. I can win. I don't know if I can beat Michael Phelps. Is anyone else out there a little tired of the Michael Phelps story? Not that he doesn't deserve it, but as I was telling Sarah the other day, when somebody wins the Norwegian bronze medal or the bronze medal for Norway for the first time ever that they get a swimming medal and all it gets is about 10 seconds worth of airtime, time to move on to some other tales about the Olympics. All right, this is the wake-up call here at WNRN, and hopefully all the lovely farm girls down at Lovingston's 94.7 are listening today. Let's take a moment and thank underwriters like Angelo Contemporary Jewelry Gallery on the downtown mall, Charlottesville. Angelo exhibits over 35 nationally known American jewelry artists, including designs by LeAngelo Maracini. At Angelo, you'll find unique jewelry for any occasion. Custom designs are available, too, by appointment. That's Angelo on the downtown mall. More can be found at angelojewelry.com. All right. As the Olympics have become a major part of daily life here for American citizens, we have invited a special guest to talk about that. We do have Professor Bradley Reed in the studio today. Brad, how are you?
Great, Rick. Thanks.
So, thank you for coming in. You were just in China like a week ago, right? 10 days ago.
I got back about 10 days ago after 6 weeks there.
And so I send you this email, and I think the reply was, well, I'm a little dizzy right now with the calendar, but let me get back and figure things out.
Yeah, exactly. I got back sometime in the first week of August. And it always takes me a little while to get reoriented.
So, Professor Brad Reed here in the studio, professor of history at UVA, specializing in late imperial and modern China, correct?
That's right.
As someone who didn't particularly focus on China, and my history team seemed to focus a little bit more on southern.
The imperial period stretches from 220 BCE to 1912. Late imperial is generally from the 10th century to 1912, and modern is 20th century.
That's still a rather large
pretty
gap
hefty
there.
Chunk of time, yes.
Yeah. I can imagine that included a lot of reading.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. All my right. Research is a little bit tighter than that, but that's pretty much my teaching responsibility.
All right, so Professor Bradley Reed here in the studio today. Well, my goal and what I'm trying to get the professor to talk about, I want to talk about China and the Olympic effect of what's going on down there. Hopefully we can work all that into just 1 hour.
Difficult, but we can try.
Sean's here today as we take some phone calls a little later in the hour. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. You're going to want to write that down and fire it up a little later in the program when we start taking calls. Because I guess I sort of want to lay some groundwork. You have been in China for the last 6 weeks. I guess you need to know the area before you can talk about it.
The area?
Well, you need to go to China.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you take all the time I've been in China, lived in China as either a teacher of English, a researcher, I actually worked as a tour guide for a period of time. Now, in the summers, I frequently take groups of UVA students to China. Altogether, about 6 years, 6-7 years in China. My general focus is in the far west, in Sichuan province, where the earthquake took place. But you're always going to Beijing. It's impossible to live in China and not go to Beijing, particularly when you're leading a group of students who absolutely want to see Beijing.
I'm curious, so you were there the pretty much 6 weeks out of this summer.
Yes.
What did you see, what did you witness for preparation of the Olympics coming to Beijing?
Well, it was, China this summer was striking for two reasons. The juxtaposition of the tragedy of the earthquake in Sichuan, followed immediately thereafter by the giddy anticipation of the Olympics. The two were absolutely intertwined in the media. It was impossible to escape either one. An enormous outpouring of compassion and generosity on the part of the Chinese people trying to help their brothers and sisters in Sichuan province. And, of course, preparing for the Olympics. Even if you never set foot in Beijing, you felt the preparation for the Olympics and tighter security across the nation, particularly at airports such as this, a constancy in the advertisements, sponsors, particularly global sponsors like Nike, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, all got right behind the Olympic bandwagon. In fact, they were some of the, well, to my mind, some of the worst purveyors of chauvinistic advertising, modifying their usual jingles to include victory for Chinese athletes. But immediately prior to the Olympics, a lot of what people didn't read in the newspaper here, apparently, were all the steps taken by the government in Beijing to prepare the city and the people for the Olympics. It wasn't simply reducing the number of cars on the road. It was trying to teach people to behave in what they see as a proper manner. Issuing rule books, the 28 regulations and the 4 prohibitions.
Really? What are some of those?
Numerous things that you would expect pertaining to what you can and cannot bring into any of the Olympic venues. These included large flags. They very much wanted to keep it toned down. They felt that it's bad manners to root only for your own team. And for this reason, they trained squads of cheerleaders, actually. They held nationwide tryouts for this. And the cheerleaders were trained in leading cheers, not simply for Chinese teams, but for anybody who wanted to use their talents.
Did all the Chinese cheerleaders have to be cute?
They were all pretty much cute, yeah. Yeah, men and women both. Yes, yes. That was one of the... probably one of the criteria, yes.
Yes.
Bouncy spirit, the whole nine yards. But they also, what you also didn't see were exercises such as my own personal favorite is the practice lining up day, which meant lining up in a queue to board the trains and the buses and things like that. Beijing people aren't normally very accustomed to queuing up in an orderly manner. It's sort of a free-for-all.
First come, first serve method.
No, yes.
That wasn't a kindergarten training, was get in line?
Right. No, not at all. Right. But let's see how it works. I don't know.
I'm just curious. Do you know Mandarin?
Yes, I do.
Is that one of the requirements to be able to teach?
I wouldn't say it's a requirement, but you'd never get a job if you didn't. Right?
And you're going the length of time that you mentioned having spent over your teaching years and et cetera, the amount of time you would, I guess, be forced to learn Mandarin. You can't just walk around.
No, it was an object of mine, even back in college, was to learn Mandarin, and that's probably the first reason why I went to China, was to actually learn how it's spoken on the streets.
We're talking with Professor Brad Reed from the University of Virginia. He's a professor of history. As we talk about what's going on with the Olympics and what's happening in Beijing and the rest of China and how they intertwine, you mentioned the changes that were made, the learning of queuing up. I think everyone has learned about the reduction in car use or automobiles of some sort. Being taken off the road. Were all the citizens in approval of this?
Well, it's a bit difficult to gauge citizen approval.
I mean, we all know that you can't take 1 billion people and make 1 billion people all follow the same thing. And and even if there's one percentage that's unhappy, I understand that. That's not the direction of the question.
So my bellwether when I travel in China are cab drivers. You're in a cab for a relatively short duration. They realize you have no axe to grind. They can give you their opinion relatively freely, and most of them do. They're happy to talk, particularly when they learn that they don't have to do it in English. But also friends, shopkeepers, people I really like when I'm in China to walk around streets a lot, talk to shop owners, particularly those whom I see every day. My impression is that a lot of people, particularly cab drivers in Beijing, see the Olympics as an enormous headache. Not all cab drivers are able to partake of the increase of customers. You have to pass an English language exam to do that. So it's a big headache, but at the same time, it's also a very prideful headache. There are people all over China, despite whatever hassles or headaches, and the recognition that the Olympics are costing this nation a huge amount of money, money which could well be put to other purposes, many people think. Even those people get swelled up with pride when they begin talking about what the Olympics means to them. You also have to remember that the Chinese people from way back, from ancient times through the 20th century, through Communist Party rule, are not at all unused to being drilled in mass movements, social programs, organizations such as this. So for half the cars to disappear off the road in one day could cause inconvenience, but it's not going to cause a hue and cry and uproar that it would in other places.
You can make a call into Professor Reed if you would like. Ask a question, make a comment, 979-0919, 1-877-967-6762. That's 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. We also can take your instant message. That's WNRN Studio on the AOL service. Professor, there's also, you know, what I've heard through reading the newspaper, you know, listening to news stations that were not WNRN at the time, that there were a lot of hotel folks who attempted to make a lot of money, people who saved those dates for Olympic time, who are losing the shirts off their back, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm not terribly familiar with the preparations that these people went through. But I have heard reports since coming back from China, of course, that occupancy rates are really, really quite low in the major hotels. Attendance at the Olympic events themselves has been low, lower than anticipated, for some reason, despite the fact that all the tickets have been sold. Frequently, there is only 50%, maybe 60% capacity in a particular venue. I have heard, I don't have any confirmation on this, that the government is actually talking about recruiting factory workers who aren't working now because their factories have been shut down to stop the pollution, going out and giving them free tickets so they will attend the events to make it seem as if there are more people. But, yeah, the anticipation was huge, and it's not what was expected. They are losing money.
I see there's a phone call out there from Sean. Hopefully this person will stay on the air rather than give me one of those questions to read. You never know. Let's take a moment and thank Brown Toyota for supporting us today. Looking for an economical vehicle? Then here's your chance. Through August 31st, it's Toyota's National Clearance Event at Brown Toyota, which includes new and pre-owned vehicles. Every vehicle is included in the event. Brown Toyota, Route 250 East Pantops. For more info, it's brownautos.com. Is Adam still on the line? All right. We got Adam here who wants to talk about cultural differences. Adam, you ready?
Yes. Professor, well, good morning, first of all. And I'd like you just to maybe expound on the idea that you could actually go to the Chinese people and instruct them to, you know, cheer this way. You should also cheer for other teams, other countries. And, you know, and that, it occurs to me that you could never do that with an American audience. They just wouldn't do it. And it's just, it's fascinating to me that you could go to the Chinese people and actually get them to comply. And not only that, but also, and again, sort of the corollary to that, the idea that you could get half of the cars off the road in Beijing, and I understand that there are different logistical reasons why, but also you could never get Americans to do that either, even, you know, for national, you know, love or unity or anything else. So it's just interesting to me that you could get that sort of behavioral cooperation from the Chinese people, if you could just speak to that.
Oh, absolutely. The basic orientation culturally is, whereas in the West we are more individually oriented. If you do something, it's your own responsibility. If you get into trouble, it's your responsibility. It doesn't reflect on anybody but yourself. You feel that if you have basic rights, such as driving your car, like rooting for whom you want to root. In China and across East Asia, really, it's quite different. It's more of a community-oriented. It's less the individual, more the team, more the country, more the group to which you belong. I remember the first time I ever went to a Japanese baseball game, I was stunned. When your team is at bat, you cheer. When your team is not at bat, you don't make a noise. You don't make a sound. You sit there very quietly, which, of course, would never happen in the United States. Same thing with the Chinese Olympics. There is a sense of decorum. There is a sense of proper behavior, of a way to act. And as for the cars on the road, a lot of people are irritated, but at the same time, a lot of people are really quite relieved. Beijing is currently putting 1,000 cars on the road a day. 1,000 cars on the road every day. Those are new cars, new registrations. And the gridlock in Beijing is beyond belief. It makes anything you would see in Washington, D.C. or New York pale in comparison. Many people are relieved that these steps are being taken. Although it's not without some trouble.
All right, Adam, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Professor, this is Professor Brad Reed as we talk about China and the Olympic effect that goes with it. Professor is from University of Virginia in the History Department. Professor, you mentioned the number of cars going on the road per day, and you just came back within the last 2 weeks. Is the smog that bad? Is the pollution that bad? It was the topic beforehand about the cars coming off the road. I actually have two friends who live in China. He went over there for his work, and his wife followed along so they could be together. And he came back and said, "You're right. It's incredibly hot. The worst time of year. It's, you know, muggy, sticky, miserable, and the pollution is there." Did you find the same thing? But they do not live in Beijing. They live, right. I won't say on the other side of China, yes. But right. Certainly in a much, right. In a much further area.
If you live in an urban area of China, the pollution is ubiquitous. It's always there. Beijing pollution is incredible. On a good day in Beijing in the summer with the air inversions and the haze that's there constantly anyway, the humidity, the air seems to take on a brown quality, and you can't see much more than a couple blocks down the street. This has become exponentially worse in the last 10 years due to the influx of private automobiles, which is something that everybody wants and which automobile makers across the world.
Are the Chinese angry or ashamed about all these stories that are coming out around the world?
No, because most Chinese people acknowledge that pollution is a huge problem. It's also, it's not just auto exhaust, it's environmental degradation due to factory runoff, to the destruction of woodlands and wetlands, and there is still an emergent but emerging environmental movement in China. And the automobile industries, which, as I was saying, automobile companies across the world want to sell every Chinese person a car. It's a bottomless market as far as they're concerned. But it's one that is actually destroying the atmosphere.
What about when the, and I don't believe it was just the American athletes, but here we only hear about the American athletes,
right,
who arrived into, I guess, the Beijing airport and had their masks on from the moment that they stepped off the plane, and then were later, I'm assuming by some sort of American public relations, asked to apologize for doing that. But those were the photos,
yeah,
of them,
yeah,
coming out of the airport wearing their masks.
Yeah. It's not far different. It is insulting. And no Chinese person would tell you that, because their sense of decorum and politeness towards the guest, which you always are in China, is too great. But privately, it would be insulting. It's not unsimilar to the tourist, to the tourist who comes and goes to a Chinese restaurant and breaks out their own knife and fork and spoon, afraid of touching anything for fear of getting some dread disease. It's an insult.
All right, 11:22 here in the wake-up call, as we talk with University of Virginia Professor Brad Reed, specialist in late imperial and modern China, about his recent visits to China and what goes on, what has been going on with the Olympics.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
Oh, let me give you the weather report. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley sunny today. Highs 85 to 90, mostly clear tonight. Lows 55 to 60. A little warmer in Richmond. Mostly sunny tomorrow's highs 90 to 95. Clear across the listening area, 77 in the valley, 79 in Lynchburg, 83 in Richmond. Here in the beautiful Charlottesville, 77. And let's take a moment and thank Alt Energy of Charlottesville for supporting us today. They design and install solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy Systems are now practical and reliable and can pay for themselves in just a few years while reducing your carbon footprint. You can also make a difference by replacing incandescent bulbs with compact fluorescents or showering instead of taking a bath. More can be found at altenergyincorporated.com. All right, back with Professor Reed. Feel free to dial us up and ask a question, such as Adam did, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, and send your email or your instant message, WNRN-Studio, on the AOL line. All right, Professor, I'm curious. We've said several times the Chinese were so put in such an effort to make this, you know, just the event, not just the event of the year, but the event of their lives. And I'm curious, what true expectations did they have? I mean, you can't just say, let's make it the greatest thing ever. But I'm curious as to what aspirations they really had in hosting the Olympics, because this goes everywhere. It's for the country. It's for their own citizens. It's, you know, their image to the rest of the world.
You're absolutely right, Rick. This is in many ways China's post-Mao coming out party. It's easy to see a lot of this as simply government manipulation. The government of China, both in imperial times and in the 20th century, and particularly since 1949 under the Communist Party, the government excels at staging things, at manipulating things, at creating grand displays, whether it be a parade of military might down Tiananmen Avenue or staging the Olympics. They excel at this kind of thing. And the opening ceremony, as everyone who saw it can attest, was a beautiful example of such staging. Everything is being minutely controlled down to the last nugget. What are they trying to get out of this? Well, it's clear and apparent and obvious that this is, in one way, a means by which the government of China, the current government of China, can legitimize itself, both in the international arena and with its own people. On the other hand, to reduce it to a political ploy or to political theater, if you would, misses one really big element, and that is the enormous pride that the Chinese people themselves feel here. China, from the early 19th century through the 20th century, was increasingly immiserated, invaded by European powers, by Japan, poverty-stricken, kicked around, beat around. They stood up in 1949 when Mao Zedong and the Communist Party took power, but never really gained, under Mao, global clout, economic clout. Since the post-Mao era dawned and the reforms have come, it's a new China. It's a new place. Anyone who goes there can attest that. The Chinese people themselves want the world to see that. It's not simply the government. It's, you can't help but get infected with this feeling of excitement when you're there. So I keep a pretty jaded view of the Olympics anyway, no matter when, where it is. The Phelps thing that you mentioned earlier could be matched perhaps only by the story of the American gymnasts. But it's undeniable in China. But the refreshing thing in China, and one of the reasons I so like watching the Olympics when I'm in China, is most Chinese people on the street have at least a passing familiarity with the other athletes. Okay? It's even more than that. In the United States, we don't know many athletes except for our professional athletes. How many people in the United States could name the leaders of the American women's volleyball team, for example? Virtually none.
That's true. I mean, there's always the joke made about every 4 years is when we watch sports that we don't otherwise care about.
Exactly. In China, they do watch them, and they do care about them. Even the more arcane sports to them, fencing, you can watch it on primetime. Also, they know the names and possibly, quite possibly, the records of a lot of international players. Before they come to Beijing, they're looking for these people. So it's a much smarter crowd in that way. It's a much smarter audience, and it's a joy to watch it.
11:28 here on the Wake Up Call with Professor Brad Reed from the University of Virginia's History Department. Professor, you were talking about what the aspirations are of China as a country and as the government, but what does the government... What are the aspirations of the government for their personal citizens? Because, you know, do they want the citizens... The pride is there regardless of whether the Olympics are there. That's what I've learned so far from our original 29 minutes, is that that is the case. The citizens are proud of China. And you mentioned that that's the case for much of the other Asian countries out there. But by hosting the Olympics, by devoting so much time and effort and money into building these venues, some of which are just amazing, architecturally amazing, does the country want the citizen, the everyday citizen of China, to come away with something particular?
I don't know if it's something particular, or quite sure what you mean by particular, but it is very much a confidence-building operation. A government that can be seen to build a successful Olympics, to pull off a successful Olympics.
Let me step in. What I mean is that there's so much going on now in China with economically, the free market system is out there. Is the country's government trying to show the citizens, and I guess this transforms itself to the world in general, that the one-party system can work. Look what the one-party system can do. Don't just have pride in your country and the athletes to go with it, but have faith that, you know, don't kick us out. Mm. Stop, having showings against us.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. Political action, direct political action in China has been virtually non-existent since 1989. That doesn't mean there isn't dissent and there aren't different forms of political action. The government has, since 1989, relied increasingly on rising standards of living to buttress its hold on power. And that hold on power is increasingly divorced from the ideology that the government espouses of socialism. There's very little, if anything, socialist about China anymore, other than the name of the government. The government is seeking legitimacy in the eyes of the people by showing that it serves the interests of the Chinese people, both economically and diplomatically at large in the world community. That they don't have to seek a change in government. Perhaps it's just like you said, don't kick us out. Although I would hesitate to put it in quite that pleading of a way. It's we're not going anywhere, so deal with it. is more likely.
And you would know better.
Maybe. But yes, they are trying to legitimize themselves in the eyes of their own people. Whether or not they will be successful is no one can know. They are constantly changing there. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see political reform take place in China within the next couple of years. I would be equally not surprised to see it not take place for the next 10 years. Of trying to figure out what the government of China is going to do is really a fool's game.
All right, let me take a moment here to do some underwriting as we have Professor Brad Reed in the studio today talking about China and the Olympic effect. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN rocks if you'd like to play along in today's Olympic game. Let me thank Blue Ridge Graphics. They are at Meade Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. All right, Professor, here's a phone caller question. You mentioned change, political change. What kind are you talking about?
Primarily, I'm talking about greater representation of various groups within China. There are now a number of non-governmental organizations that deal with everything from women's rights to environmental issues. What kind of power they have to set policy, what kind of flack they get from the government, varies from group to group. And when I talk about change and political change in China, we are essentially talking about loosening up the hold of the central government on the political process. This could be a relaxation of controls that would allow for freer elections at the local level, which I suspect is where it will first occur, all the way up to a greater and more meaningful debate at the center, where the Congress and the People's Congress has generally served as a rubber stamp for higher political authority. There are now occasions in which genuine debate is breaking out in the halls of the Congress. That's the kind of change that I'm looking for or expecting, not revolutionary or cataclysmic change, but reformist change. These are not fools in Beijing. They know that reform is going to be necessary. But they want to see it step-by-step guided change. Chinese political thinkers, Chinese people in general, are very wary of a relaxation of state control because it can lead directly to chaos.
Were you surprised, we mentioned earlier, the Olympic opening ceremony and the beauty of it? The involvement of Tiananmen Square in that because of, I guess, the way the world views that and the representation that goes with that name and that picture?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Tiananmen, the students of 1989 were no fools either when they chose Tiananmen as the site for their demonstration. It is the political center of gravity in China. If you've ever been there, you know what I'm talking about when I say this. It's impossible to grasp the immensity and the power, the symbolic power of that square until you are actually standing in it. It's a huge, vast, open area flanked on one side by the people's, the Hall of the People, on the other side by the Revolutionary Museum. Mao's mausoleum is sitting behind you, and there in front of you is the gates to the Forbidden City, the traditional seat of power. Using that as part of the opening ceremonies was a no-brainer. It re-symbolizes the square for a different meaning. People in China, throughout Chinese history, in the last 200, 300 years, have tried to appropriate that area for their own different purposes, particularly since the square was made into the square it is today. It's the prime site for parades, for demonstrations. Everybody wants to use that square for its symbolic purpose. And what the government is trying to do with these opening ceremonies is to re-script the square, so to speak, give it a different public image for the world.
And do you think that that will happen as we move forward?
Yeah. I think people, it's sad to say, even the students that I talk about, the riots of, or the demonstrations of 1989 used to be a hot topic with students. Now it's ancient history. And in China, too, it's passing. Those who went through that movement are now pretty much irrelevant to all but a few intellectuals.
All right, 11:39 here in the Wake Up Call with Professor Brad Reed as we talk about the Olympic effect on China and the rest of the world through China and Beijing. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Justine Abshire was found dead on a road in November 2006. That much is fact. How she died and who might be responsible remain questions, however. Courtney Stewart visits widower Eric Abshire to clear up some of the mystery. Jinx Barbecue has won some awards, including a recent national number one. Now owner Jinx Kern is on the Hook's interview hot seat. And speaking of food, what caused the tavern to close down twice and then allow them to be open again? The Hook, it may be free, but this is no generic paper. And let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support today. You can go back to school mountain style this year with packs, footwear, and clothing from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports. Blue Ridge has over 15 styles of packs from the North Face, and if it's a padded laptop or courier bag you're looking for, Blue Ridge has them too. From The Ground, Timbuktu, and Patagonia, Blue Ridge Mountain Sports can be found at the Barracks Road Shopping Center in Charlottesville and at BRMS.com. All right, Sean's here to answer the calls. Professor Reed's here to answer your questions. Bring them on if you'd like. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. If you just want to listen, I got tons of questions. No need to worry about that. All right, Professor Reed, back in action now. A couple simple questions, because we've talked about pride multiple times here throughout the hour. How important are the medals to the Chinese? I know that here in America, we always keep the medal count. Who's in the lead? Have I won more, you know, has the country won more gold medals than someone else?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, medals are important to almost all participating nations. For China and the United States, as used to be with the Soviet Union, it reaches an almost maniacal proportions of keeping track. I think I lost track myself. I think the United States is ahead in total medals, but China is ahead in gold. The medals count as markers of achievement and pride. I just read in the Washington Post yesterday Chinese woman's sharpshooter. I'm not sure what you call that sport, shooting air guns.
Target shooting?
Target shooting, something like that. How when she missed the medals in the first event, she was ridiculed online by people, her neighbors, on the web, incessantly being ridiculed that the government had paid for her training, supported her, yada, 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 and she should be ashamed for having let the people down. She's been somewhat redeemed by winning a gold several events later. But the Chinese pride in the medals can be really, really vociferous at times. Of course, it's not everybody, but enough.
Is this a method, and it may be for far more than just the Chinese, mm-hmm. Certainly know that we could say this somewhat about the Americans, if not completely, that winning the medal count, having more gold medals, pride factors in to make you better culturally and the better country. Does that factor in any way into the Chinese thinking way of mind?
Well, sure. I'm not sure if it factors in culturally any more than it would factor in with other nations. But the medals, leading the medal count, is a sign of progress, of development of their sports programs.
How about yes, exactly. How about that they have a better sports program where you, and I believe this happens in other countries as well, where you identify the young, the kids mm-hmm. with talent, and you ship them off to the school that represents that sport.
Right.
Rather than in the United States where we do things a little differently.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. This is, I think the model was first created by the Soviet Union in their sports program, their Olympic program. And it's largely been modeled or taken up by the Chinese. The really frightening part for me is you take that extreme training program and then shoot it full of cash from corporate sponsors, and you have a true monster on your hands in which the individuals themselves could well be squished. It's, in many cases, less a matter of personal desire than it is a matter of this is what my body was good for and this is what the state has been training me to do. Although, you know, I say that with some hesitancy because most Chinese athletes are very, very happy to do what they're doing, particularly now when the potential is growing for Chinese athletes to make a lot of money in China, not just the Yao Mings who come to the United States and become basketball stars, but the track stars, the ping pong stars, the gymnasts. Stand to make a lot of money in China.
Let me jump on some, I guess, some issues that have made it around the world. What were some of the Chinese reactions with the possible underage gymnasts? Were you aware when that came out?
Yeah, I mean, I just heard it with the rest, with everyone else in the news. I don't think that there has been an official Chinese reaction. I may be wrong, but...
Well, I'm talking about the taxi drivers.
Right.
That you mentioned earlier where...
Oh, the taxi driver, I could well imagine, would be the knowing smile or the, what do you expect? Of course, that's just the way it is. It's also one of these things about the Olympics where China is in the hot seat now, or not the hot seat, but under the magnifying glass. Violation of such rules happens on a fairly regular basis. It's not a big surprise to anybody. I think what was surprising was when you look at those Chinese gymnasts, it's impossible to even imagine that they are 16 years old. I don't think that the Chinese people would really get all that excited about it. A few will begin blogging, saying that the government should not have violated the rules in this manner, or that the girls themselves shouldn't have violated the rules in this manner. More and more, that's the case. It's up to the individual coach, up to the individual players, less up to the government as a...
Is that because the expectation is that the government will do it this way?
No, it's simply that the government, as the state with a capital S, takes less and less direct control. It's a bureaucratically organized system, and control ultimately comes down to the coaches and those individuals who govern that individual sport. I could see in the future more regulations on the Chinese side to cut back on this underage competing.
How about the opening ceremony lip sync? Because that's certainly gotten a lot of grief.
Yeah.
On this side of the water, so to speak.
Well, that cuts with the American lip sync, the
Milli Vanilli guys. It's like, hey, it's not like we don't do that all the time. Right. I mean, I heard somebody say we do that at the Super Bowl every year. You know, what's the big deal?
But the Chinese, I think, would express a fair degree of incomprehension at the big fuss about it. As I think I read in the paper, one of the Chinese officials said, well, this girl had the perfect face and this girl had the perfect voice. One's voice was unsuitable, one's face was unsuitable. So they're really, what's the problem? We don't get it. It's a performance. And that's what they're really after. It's a performance.
And what about the, and it had a particular name, I suppose, because of the site. But the killing that happened earlier on with the, I guess, a relative to one of the coaches, a stabbing. Was it the drum tower?
Yes, at the drum tower in Beijing. A drum tower is almost every major imperial city in China had a drum tower to signal time. It's an imposing structure. The killing itself was shocking. It shocked everybody, and it remains under investigation. It's a little bit difficult because the guy killed himself. One of the striking things about China today is during the what we would refer to as the Maoist era or the period of real control, everybody in China was enrolled into a bureaucratic organization, a neighborhood committee, a workplace, and these organizations kept track of you. They've supplied housing, medical food, or food, medicine, schooling, and they also kept an eye on everybody, whether for good or bad. Now, with the collapse of that system, you have a lot more people out on the street, a lot more homeless people, a lot more disgruntled individuals.
I think that people don't have an image of homeless people in China. Poor farmers, maybe, but not homeless people in the urban areas.
The numbers are increasing. And homelessness is perhaps less disturbing than the floating around of unstable individuals. This summer in Shanghai, an individual walked into a police station in Shanghai and stabbed 6 officers and wounded 14 others. A bomb went off in Shanghai in May on a bus. 2 bombs exploded on buses in Kunming in Yunnan province in July. All of these are unsolved, with no one laying claim and no one arrested for them. China is a more unstable place. They want to project the image of absolute safety and security, the harmonious society, as the official phrase goes. But to be honest, there is a lot more tension and a lot more, I hesitate to use the term violence, but there's a lot more brewing just beneath the surface in China these days.
11:50 on the wake-up call. Lazarus has entered the room. Lazarus the dog is now hanging out with Professor Brad Reed, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia, as we talk about China. and the Olympics and how they are intertwined not only amongst the country but around the world. Let me take a moment and thank 45fix.com for supporting us today. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate no-obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And Drew Thompson has also entered the room today. Drew's here for Les Temps Purdue, the best of 80s and 90s alternative. He won't play New Kids on the Block or Aerosmith or Kylie Minogue, but you will hear Bare Naked Ladies, Aha, and Hole. Requests always welcome. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music, only on WNRN. All right, back to Professor Reed. I didn't bring this up earlier because I didn't want the hour to be filled with political conversations about this. I wanted to talk about economics and the other nuances that go around China. But there were a lot of world issues just coming up before the Olympics began, such as the run of the torch. Were you there? Were you in China at the time?
I think the torch was running in China by the time I got there. I was not in China for the events, I think, you're referring to.
Like the hiding of the torch in San Francisco,
right.
and all
right.
the other sort of demonstrations that went around wherever it visited another country.
Yes. Yeah. No, I was still here in the States. Although that too did, when I got to China, people did comment about it, the troubles the torch had and how people don't understand. This should be an apolitical event, they would try to explain to me. There's a lot going on internationally that people can be upset about, rightfully, or right or wrong.
Does that
it was a huge black eye for the Chinese government.
Does that factor in with the pride of the country, or do you think that they truly believe that it should be an apolitical event, or that they just wanted it to be an apolitical event because it otherwise got in the way of their goals of hosting the Olympics?
Well, I think anybody who really says that the Olympics should be an apolitical event is talking through their hat to start with, because the Olympics have never been apolitical. What they want, what the Chinese government, I think, wants is for the world's attention to be restricted not on these other nasty, pernicious issues, but on the Olympics, only the Olympics, and we'll deal with these other issues later.
How were journalists being handled while you were there?
I don't know. I don't know of any.
Because there is only one state newspaper in China. Is that correct?
Oh, no. There are. Chinese people are much more avid readers than most Americans are. If you go to any newsstand, there's probably about, I'd say 30 newspapers sitting out there, magazines and such. There is a leading newspaper that represents the voice of the party, generally,
okay.
The People's Daily. But actually, outside of Beijing, no one really reads that newspaper, except to figure out what the government is saying. I don't know. I didn't hear any stories about how journalists were being treated. Journalists are generally quite free in China these days to go do what they want to do. They have to check in. They have to... on occasion have special minders. But I haven't heard if they're trying to put on a song and dance show for the journalists. That's no longer really feasible in China anymore because of the relatively greater freedom. People can move around, can see more. I really don't know if the journalists are being handled all that much now.
We talked briefly earlier in the hour about the economic expense that the country put forward to hosting the Olympics. Was there any backlash or negative demonstrations because of the earthquake and its sort of the money for guns rather than the money for butter issue?
Right. In this case, money for pole vaulters rather than money for...
For home, houses, for people right. who are now homeless well, because of...
Two things. One is the amount of money spent by the Olympics has come up as a point of conversation, not only amongst people on the street, taxi drivers, if you will, but also in the government itself. There have been critics of the amount of money spent. As for the earthquake, that was an incredibly moving thing to see. The Chinese response to the earthquake of Sichuan puts the American response to the Katrina disaster to a horrible degree of shame. The transparency of the government's initial response, the solicitation of non-governmental independent help, almost every city in China, I, for example, was living in Shanghai for most of the 6 weeks I was there this time, it's impossible to go to a department store without seeing donation kiosks. The government is pumping in huge amounts of money to rebuild these villages that were destroyed. So they are allocating their resources in what appears to be a humane and wise manner. It's the other problems in Chinese society, the rising unemployment, for example, the environmental problems, those are the areas where many people felt this money should have been spent.
All right, 11:57 as we wind up our hour with Professor Brad Reed from UVA's Department of History. Let me remind you, you are listening to WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS-FM, Sweetbriar, Amherst, Lynchburg, Drew Thompson on the mic in just a few moments. Professor, we have these incredible architectural designs, the bird's nest, the ice cube.
The water cube. Yes.
Thank you. And I'm assuming that there are one or two others that we will see events from during the second week of the Olympics.
Yes.
And we were talking about money spent. What will these be used for later? I mean, we can look at the Americans, you know, we'll look at, I believe, the Canadian, the Montreal Olympics were in 76.
Something like that.
And Olympic Stadium is now a piece of trash.
Yep.
It has concrete falling through it, and it can't be used anymore, and the baseball team has moved on. L.A. Coliseum, which was from much earlier time but was refurbished for the 84 Olympics, now they talk about how they can't do things there. National Football League teams do not want to be in that stadium. But what happens to this?
Well, I'm sure that the plans are to make Beijing a major international venue for international competitions, as well as use those as a marquee venue for domestic competitions.
Is that as they take their place in the more modern world?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm sure it will function that way for a while, but as you say, there's no guarantee that these will not fall into disrepair, particularly once the smog returns to Beijing.
All right, Professor, thank you so much for being with us today. I found it quite enlightening. I hope others did as well. Drew Thompson up next for Les Temps Purdue. Adios.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.org. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.